Welcome, amigos, to episode 64 of the Natch GM Show, sponsored by No Halftime and the No Halftime app, the only podcast available via the Natch GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatchGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. As I mentioned, this podcast is sponsored by No Halftime and No Halftime app. You're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team. But your fantasy sports service doesn't allow you to. Now you can on the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera versus Dee Gordon, or Chris Davis versus Matt Kemp. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, or other sports. Join today and get started. Real money and fantasy supremacy awaits you. And now, you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering in the promo code NATSGM at signup. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break. Now to our guest this week.
This is Mike Farron from SiriusXM's MLB Network Radio, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
This week, I am proud to welcome author at Baseball Prospectus, RotoWire, and RotoGrinders, co-host of Baseballaholics Anonymous podcast, and co-author of Arm Action, Arm Path, and The Perfect Pitch, Doug Thorburn. Doug, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Oh, thanks so much, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
And I really appreciate you coming on. I'm a big fan of your work at particularly at Baseball Prospectus and your podcast. So it's very exciting for me to, I guess, hear your voice and talk a little baseball with you today.
Well, thanks. That's way too kind. Me, I'm always down to talk baseball. So bring it on.
Well, let's dive right in. You are a, and if you don't want to call yourself it, I call you a pitching guru. And so I really want to focus on kind of the pitching side talking to you today. And some of my questions, I just want to start out with some general things. But first place I want to start with is just, I want to give you the floor, you know, without a better way to say it, of just to talk about a little bit of the Tommy John epidemic we're seeing going on in Major League Baseball, and even at the lower, you know, at the younger ages now, and just kind of your thoughts. You wrote a column at BP this week or last week of kind of touching on this subject, so I kind of want to just hear your thoughts.
Yeah, to me, the game, the way it's going, the direction it's evolving, it's not a surprise at all to me that we're seeing just a sea of busted UCLs right now, and we're seeing so many Tommy John injuries. Over at ASMI, they do some incredible research. It's actually very similar to the research we used to do. I used to work at the National Pitching Association with Tom House. And so it's slightly different direction, but we're using similar technology. Basically, you throw harder, you're putting higher joint loads on UCLs, on basically everything. But the UCL is the most sensitive. And so by throwing harder, you're putting more strain on the UCL. That's just in a vacuum, a basic thing that we understand. And today's culture is obsessed with velocity. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're seeing velocity that we've never seen before. It's funny actually how some scouts, they really haven't adjusted their scale, you know, like the 2080 scouting scale. You'll hear velocity or fastballs graded based on velocity first and foremost. And it's interesting to me how, for example, 92 to 93, that used to be a plus fastball. Now it's average. Yeah. But there's still a lot of scouts that will throw a 60 on it. The problem is everybody's a 60 to them. And meanwhile, as you go further and further down, whether it's showcases, whether it's high school ball, college ball, velocity is king. And I've always found it interesting because there has, you know, long been this kind of discussion or debate about the relative merits of sabermetrics and scouting. And to me, you know, nowadays we're a little more enlightened as a group. We understand as baseball fans that both of these things play a role. But there's been this connector that brings the two together that's been around for a long time called the radar gun. It's the only objective measurement that a scout has. He can go home and he can say, you know, I really like this guy's swing path, or wow, look at the downhill plane on his pitches, or talk about all this nuance. But the one thing they can put on a scouting report that is objective is to say, oh, he was sitting 92 to 94 today, and he spiked 96. That is unbiased. It's not what somebody else is saying. It's what the radar gun said. They're just reporting it. And that has become a crutch for a lot of scouts. And we have sites like Brooks Baseball, which is powered by Baseball Prospectus, and they have amazing data when it comes to stuff. So it's fantastic overall, but it's interesting to me how that one objective measurement is really the key that brings together the sabermetric side and the scouting side, and that aspect hasn't been appreciated, even though it hasn't been appreciated from a macro scale. You take a step back and people don't see that, but when we look at the reality of what's happening, people absolutely appreciate that, just in overvaluing velocity. And so that's, to me, that's what we see now. And so when I see the Tommy John epidemic that we're witnessing, it's because we have a culture that's obsessed with velocity. It's not just that guys are throwing hard, but they're throwing harder for these short little bursts. It used to be you want a starting pitcher to go 7 or 8 innings, you know, even in the modern, more modern times like the 90s and the one inning closer and everything else. You know, once we got past the complete game era and when Nolan Ryan was throwing, you know, 300 pitches in a game, moving on to this the modern era, it's very interesting to see how it's evolved from one starter who goes 7 to 8 followed by a closer to now starters are expected to go 6 innings, 100 pitches, full bore, every single pitch, give way to the 7th inning guy if you have a lead, then give way to the 8th inning guy, then a 9th inning guy. It's basically pitchers are going 100% all the time, and that didn't used to be the case. They used to kind of float their way through. In fact, if you look at the velocity numbers for pitcher versus pitcher, so National League, obviously, pitcher versus opposing pitcher versus all batters, most pitchers take it easy. They have that gear. They have the ability to, but rather than picking their spots, they're just going full bore the whole time, and the body's not designed to do that, especially as we're throwing harder and harder, and in the modern world that we're living in, velocity takes such a center stage that pitch command, which to me is the most important aspect, gets shoved to the back. So we're adding power to these unstable systems. And whether it's baseball or your car, that's a bad idea.
So this is such a difficult question, but then so how does it change? Or does it change?
I am really worried. This was the inspiration for the article, actually. It's something I've seen this. I'm kind of entrenched in this on multiple levels because I also do scouting. I also do, whether it's amateur and – you know, I do the pro evaluations for BP, but I see it all the way down. I see it all the way down to the amateur level, and it's frightening because we have a lot of instructors out there right now, and some who make themselves very loud and make themselves heard, who are basically saying that if you throw hard enough with enough movement, it doesn't matter where the ball goes. And I was raised under the complete opposite hierarchy, where command was king. Movement was secondary and velocity was last. You only add velocity once you have a stable system. But that's not what's being coached right now. We're coaching a bunch of guys who don't have a system that can withstand velocity, and we're adding velocity more and more because, hey, radar gun, you can advertise that. If you're a pitching coach who is trying to make money with his business, it's a lot easier to advertise, hey, we pumped this guy up from 83 to 89 than it is to say, look at his command. Good luck with that.
Yeah, those are all fantastic points, and I go back to the one you made about the scouting as well. It's, you know, we all sit in the stands, and it's really easy to sit there with the radar gun and see what they throw and write that down. I mean, like you say, it's the only objective thing that you can put down there, and for a scout, that can cover your rear end.
Yeah, well, and I think that's a great point, because if you're a scout and you recommend a guy who's sitting low 90s in the radar gun, well, he better succeed, because if he doesn't, that's a scout's fault. He should have known better. But if a guy is sitting high 90s and he fails, that's a player's fault. because what scout wouldn't want that guy in the system? Oh, but the players are some of them just aren't natural. They're not going to make it. So if he didn't make it, well, that's the player's problem. It boils down to what the job of scouting is and what their job has become. It's no longer being able to really identify those things that are different. It's making sure you don't steer too far away from the crowd, because that's what stands out.
Yeah. This is kind of a similar question, but it builds off of my first question. Obviously, Jeff Passan just came out with The Arm, the big, you know, his book. I'm assuming you've read it at this point. I'd love to get your thoughts on the book.
What's funny, I actually haven't read the book yet, but I talked to Jeff a little bit about it while he was doing the research for the book and kind of getting ready for it. So I haven't seen the exact details that are in there, but I'm willing to bet, based on our conversation, that it's similar to what I've experienced. And what kills me is that this has been building, that this has been a reality for the last 5 or 6 years, but we're just now realizing it. And the warning flags have been around for 5 or 6 years. You know, the injury rates have been off the charts for several years now, and people have been trying to find a problem. Meanwhile, a different group of people are saying, wow, look at how hard guys are throwing, and pretending like there's no connection, which is insane.
So how does this – so are we just, you know, kind of in the middle of this? We've got 15 to another – let me rephrase. We've got another generation where we're just going to watch these pitchers break down before things – you know, slowly get better?
I think until the game evolves again, and the game of baseball is very traditionalist, is very slow to evolve, and it's hard to argue with the results. You look at how dominant pitching is, how many guys are being converted to relief and that are effective, how many guys can succeed, especially in relief, just by throwing hard with a ton of movement and having no idea where the baseball is going. It's going to be really hard to reverse that, and especially because it's perpetual all the way down to when guys are 10 years old. It's amazing. Yeah. These kids who want velocity readings. At the MPA, we would work with kids age 8 all the way up to future Hall of Famers. And some of these kids would want to put the radar gun on, and we just wouldn't let them. Because who cares how hard they throw now? They're growing, you know, so quickly, it's ridiculous. I used to tell parents all the time that the biggest risk that their child faces is to be really good when he's 12. Yeah. Because he has a growing body that's going to be overworked, and this, you know, being able to play in Williamsport is not worth his baseball career.
I mean, I can't tell you the number of parents that have asked me, can you put your radar gun on my son? I'm like, he's 12. What does it matter? Yeah. Go to a speed pitch if you really care. I mean,
yeah, well, and it's funny. There's so many aspects to it where when they're 12, I just want them to throw.
Right.
Stop trying to be a pitcher. Just throw. Stop worrying about curveballs. Just throw fastballs. Just put the ball where you want to. Emphasize command. Build arm strength through repetition. And then as they grow into the body that they are, and as they're building up that baseline, the whole idea is to have that physical baseline. I'm not saying to ignore physical development. Quite the opposite, in fact. I want to emphasize physical development, but without actually worrying about results on the mound. At that age, just keep them safe and keep building arm strength, and do so on a safe pattern. You don't want to do it where they feel the pressure of you know, Little League playoffs or something like that.
Well, and the next topic I want to broach is, we have seen shoulder injuries. I don't know, when I was growing up, I feel like we're probably close to the same age. Shoulder injuries were the death knell, and everybody heard, oh, torn rotator cuff. Oh, well, you're done. Nowadays, it feels like shoulder injuries have kind of become almost passe with pitchers. First of all, why is that? And is that something that maybe we can hope for with the UCL, you know, in 15 or 20 years?
It is encouraging. I do like to see that, because I agree with you. And I don't have the data to back it up, so I can't be sure, but it sure seems like shoulder injuries are way down. However, I don't think that UCL problem is going to go the direction of the shoulder issue. In fact, I think UCL problem is part of the reason why shoulder injuries are down. What I mean by that is basically you've got the throwing arm, and there's weak links in the throwing arm. Well, the shoulder is stabilized, the rotator cuff, by four different muscles. But the UCL is just a single ligament. So, and if it happens later in the kinetic chain of events, and it's also at the most vulnerable point, during the highest intensity phases of the pitching motion. So basically what I'm saying is that guys' UCLs are giving out way before the shoulders even have the opportunity to give out. The shoulder is a stronger system. Now, everyone's different. You're never going to completely erase those types of injuries. I remember Jake Peavy, when I was with the NPA, we used to tell the Padres back when Peavy was with them, look, he's a major risk for having his elbow blown out. So what blew out? His lat detached on his back. It's insane. Like, we wouldn't predict that injury with anybody. That was off the charts, and it's because he had exceptional joint integrity of his UCL. Well, we couldn't have figured that out without actually opening him up, which we're not going to do. So, you know, the best we can do is to make an educated guess and to say, well, other pitchers who do that have this problem. Well, he had an exceptionally strong UCL, but the general population of pitchers, the UCL is much weaker than the muscles supporting the shoulder. It's good in the sense that it's also more easy to repair. There are guys that don't come back from shoulder injuries, and so in that sense it's good. And we see plenty of pitchers who come back after that first Tommy John. But how many guys now are getting their second Tommy John and they don't come back? Not everyone comes back from that first Tommy John. And what really kills me, and this is something I brought up in the article, is to me, I see the death of the long-term starter, the guy who pitches 200 innings a year for 12 to 15 years. That's, to me, I don't see that existing. These guys are awesome for 3 to 5, which works from the team's perspective because they only have control of these guys for 6 years. So they basically, you know, wear them into the ground, and then they're someone else's problem. And so from the player's perspective, I think this is a big problem. From the team's perspective, this might actually be the most efficient way to go about it, but it's not good for player careers, and it's only good from the team's perspective as long as this population holds. And we might be in a bit of a bubble with that. We'll see.
Well, and in your answer, it got me thinking the Colorado Rockies 4 or 5 years ago really may have been onto something of having four guys that throw, I don't know, 70 or 80 pitches, and then they get yanked. And then it's just you keep setting yourself up like that. That might be where baseball would go if we were at our most optimal.
Maybe, but honestly, to be optimal, that requires an appreciation of the fact that the pitcher population is very diverse. You might have some guys who do really well off of 70 every 5 days. You might have some guys who do really well off 50 every 3 days. You might have some guys who can go 130 every five and be fine, Randy Johnson. But the current environment that we have doesn't appreciate that. Doesn't even allow for that to reveal itself. It's basically a scenario where either you have a pitcher who can go six and throw 100 pitches, or you have a guy who can throw 20 pitches in one inning, or he has no place in a major league roster. And to me, that is BS. That fails to recognize the natural diversity of human beings, let alone the pitcher population. And until we appreciate that, we're going to continue to have an issue. And the Rockies thing was different because they're at altitude and they have all sorts of things they need to try in order to make altitude work. I don't have an answer, but I have to say I think that's the coolest job in Major League Baseball is to be the pitching coach of the Rockies because he actually has the freedom to try stuff out, whereas most coaches, they're really afraid of looking dumb.
Right, and if it doesn't work, well, you're pitching coach in Colorado. It's not supposed to work. So, once again.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Next thing I got to ask you, and this kind of relates to Steven Strasburg, as we heard this a lot in D.C., I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, but he uses the inverted W position or inverse W. I've heard it so many different ways, but basically, you know, you look like an M. Is that really an injury precursor for pitchers, or is that just one of those, I don't know, urban legend type things?
There's an element to it that's an injury precursor, but it's actually a much more complicated story than we are led to believe. You know, there are people out there who will say, oh, inverted W, he's going to get hurt. Well, the inverted W is part of what I consider to be a three-layer piece of injury precursor, specifically to the elbow. Basically, you don't want the elbow to drag behind the rest of the body. You don't want it to be late. So when a pitcher has that inverted W, the elbow is naturally raised. It's raised above the shoulder line. That's the definition of it, essentially. And the biggest risk that we found at the NPA was pitchers who had what we called elbow drag, where the elbow is lagging behind the shoulder line. So imagine if you put a broomstick across the shoulders at the point of maximum external rotation. So that's the arm cocking phase when the arm kind of lays back before going forward into the highest energy phases. If a guy, his elbow is lagging behind the shoulder line at the point of max external rotation, that's a huge risk. But in order to get all the drag, that can be encouraged by the inverted W, but it doesn't have to be. It can also be encouraged by a guy who has way too long of a delay of trunk rotation. So he gets that upper body rotation element going way too late, so he has a late arm. You'll also see it from guys who have a pronounced scapular load, where that's kind of like a back shoulder pinch. So once again, their elbow ends up kind of late to the party. So we saw that as an injury precursor. So to me, the inverted W, it's an element, but it's just a piece. It's one of several things that can go on. And my biggest beef with it, my biggest problem with those who are really against the inverted W is from a coaching standpoint. No one taught Strasburg to throw that way. That's just the way he throws. From a coaching standpoint, good luck changing it. That's who he is. As a coach, you have to work around it. It's not like in fact, we used to take a lot of heat from it. One of the biggest examples of the inverted W was Anthony Reyes, which was an MPA guy, a Tom House guy. And so we would get this reputation for encouraging the inverted W. Mark Pryor had a very slight inverted W, and he was one of our guys. So people would actually claim that we were teaching them to throw with an inverted W. And the answer was no, we weren't teaching that at all. We just weren't changing it once we saw it. That's the way this guy throws, trying to alter arm action. And that's part of the reason why the book was titled Arm Action. Trying to alter is extremely difficult. Now, from a scouting standpoint, it has a lot of value, because if you see that, your coaching staff is going to have a hard time changing it. So if you consider it to be a red flag as a scout, yeah, you want to stay away, because it's going to take a long time of development to even have any shot at changing it, and you're probably still not going to. But from a coaching aspect, we would leave it alone. Once you have a pitcher who does that, okay, that's what they do, and that's a known risk. However, then the job becomes, okay, well, make sure the rest of the body and the rest of delivery is stable enough that they can withstand the extra risk they have with every throw that they make. And so the inverted W doesn't have to be a death knell, not at all. And it's very largely misunderstood. But what kills me is this idea that the player has some sort of control over it, or he's doing it on purpose. That's just the way the guy throws, and you're not going to be able to change it unless you can go back in time to when he was 8 years old and change the way he throws baseballs.
Great answer. Just fantastic. It's got me thinking of a million other things, but I want to move ahead and ask you kind of a next question. Our audience is really savvy. We've got a really strong audience in terms of baseball knowledge. So, and I get this question a lot, and so I wanted to ask you the same question. When you go to a game kind of from a scouting perspective, what are you looking at kind of first and foremost, or the first couple things you're looking at when you're looking at a pitcher?
It totally depends on where I'm sitting.
Behind home plate and you're scouting. How about that?
Yeah. Well, if I'm behind the plate, and actually I'm not big on behind the plate. Behind the plate is decent for seeing stuff, and it helps for being able to see a pitcher's vertical balance, his up, down, and to see his posture, so to see how much spine tilt he has at release point. So there are certain things that I can see from behind the plate that are nice, but I have no idea about the pitcher's momentum. I have no idea about his torque. In order to get an idea of those, I have to go down the baseline. I have to sit behind the dugout in order to see those elements. And then behind the pitcher, you end up, like from the center field standpoint, obviously you're far away, but there's other aspects you can appreciate. And the best angle actually is one that's impossible. It's the bird's eye view. And that's something that we did at the MPA. We had the technology, the same thing video games use and movie companies use, where we could go ahead and reconstruct the entire delivery and look at a guy from a bird's eye view and be able to see what kind of torque he's getting. If you know, that inverted W thing, you see all these snapshots of it from very poor angles, and these things are happening so quickly that trying to see any pitcher's delivery in a snapshot is a joke. They all look terrible. And so for me, the key really depends on where I'm sitting that day. And where I'm sitting has an impact on what I'm able to evaluate, what I'm able to appreciate. That's why I really like amateur scouting, because I can move around the ballpark a lot easier and I can see all these different aspects. But if you're sitting behind the plate, yeah, you end up becoming reliant on the radar gun, because you're kind of stuck looking at what the ball's doing.
Yeah, that's a great point. You can see what it does and how the hitter might see it, but you're exactly right. You can't see what the guy's motion is really like.
Yeah, and a great example of that is, you've heard the term front shoulder flying open.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that as a coach I never use, because from the pitcher's perspective, from a coaching perspective, they have no idea what to do with that. It makes total sense from a hitter's perspective, or the catcher, or the umpire, because that's how it looks. That front shoulder looks like it's opening up prematurely. What it really is is that the pitcher has started trunk rotation too early. So the whole upper body piece is starting rotation. Their timing is off. And I'm going to be able to see that much easier from down the baseline than I am from right behind the plate. Behind the plate, that is the best way to describe it, is, okay, it looks like the front shoulder's opening up early, which is typically premature trunk rotation, but you can't see it as well. But from a hitter's point of view or the catcher's, yeah, that is exactly what they see. And so it's the catcher's job to be able to identify it, and that's why you see the meetings on the mound sometimes, or at least that's one of the reasons. But it's something that, to me, is really underappreciated.
Once again, great point. Can we shift now? I want to get your take. I want to ask you about some specific pitchers, actually just all the way through the NL East, if I can.
You got it.
All right, let's start with Noah Syndergaard with the Mets. Unbelievable stuff, but I think we're all kind of worried and waiting that UCLA is going to blow out when he's throwing 96-mile-an-hour sliders. Just kind of what's going on with Noah Syndergaard, and is he going to stay healthy?
Well, I mean, there's natural elevation of risk because of the fact that he throws so hard. And, you know, he led the majors in fastball velocity for starters last year. I think it was a 97.7, according to Brooks Baseball. And this year it's even higher. It's like a 98.9. And it's funny, people always look at velocity early in the season and they kind of anchor on what they did last year. And when I see a guy who's down a half tick or down a full tick, it doesn't worry me too much. I'll look at, you know, most guys take some time to build their velocity to hit peak. But when I see a young player who's throwing harder than he ever has in his entire life in April, that will cause you to stand up and pay attention. And on top of that, yeah, he's throwing a slider. The slider, and you know, it's the Dan Worthen slider, it's been clocked as high as 95 miles an hour, faster than most guys' fastballs. And I think a key here is because the general baseball community has looked at the frequency of sliders and said, you know, this is dangerous, you want to go over 30%, blah, 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 blah. To me, it depends on what type of slider they're throwing. There are different ways to throw a slider. There are different ways to throw a breaking ball. There are more dangerous ways that involves twisting the wrist near release point, and which looks really cool, but actually can be identified out of hand. It's the kind of thing that tends to get beat up in the minors and addressed in the minors because all of a sudden that breaking ball is being recognized by advanced hitters. Syndergaard doesn't throw a twister slider at all. The Worthen slider is very much like a fastball. So I don't think he's putting too much extra strain on that joint. In fact, some would call it a cutter. It has more vertical movement than your typical slider. It doesn't have that 45-degree tilt angle to it. I'm not worried based off of the slider frequency. I'm not even necessarily worried based just purely on the velocity beyond a certain acceptance of, okay, his risk is elevated. But to me, he has a very stable delivery. There's certain things about genetics that we can't possibly know. But I'm not ready to be scared yet. I still consider to be the increase of velocity for this individual player to be a good thing because he has the physical foundation, the baselines to make it work. So I'm excited by it. I see a guy who was already plenty effective last year who's now throwing harder and has a new weapon that he threw the slider 3% of the time last year. It was an 88-mile-an-hour pitch. Now it's a 92-mile-an-hour pitch that he's throwing like 25% of the time. It's completely overhauled the way that he's attacking hitters. And to me, that's very exciting.
I think I just heard all the fans in the NL East collectively groan on that answer. So, nice.
Except Mets fans, yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. I do want to ask kind of a similar question about Matt Harvey. We hear, you know, the Verducci effect and all this nonsense of you come back from Tommy John and you can't throw too many innings. He threw a lot of innings last year. Are you worried about him, and what are you seeing early in the season from Matt Harvey?
Well, with that one, I'm going to defer to his pitching coach, once again, Dan Worthen. And he noticed with Harvey, especially from the stretch, he has a tendency, at least so far this season, to collapse the backside. And he phrased it as Harvey trying to throw too hard. And this happens a lot where guys, they try to increase their momentum. Sometimes you see it from the stretch. And what they mean by a collapse of the backside is that the back knee will really bend. It'll lower their center of gravity. Harvey hasn't had that problem from the windup, but he has had that problem so far from the stretch. And the fact that he's been able to cruise through his outings up until basically he's put into the stretch, that definitely lends to it. I think it's something that's fixable. I see the overall velocity is down. It's still awesome, but it is down a little bit from last year. I'm not ready to say that that's indicative of anything because of the how vague velocities can be in April. I do think that he needs to improve. I for his next start, I wouldn't be overly ecstatic that he's suddenly going to figure it all out. But he has all the baselines. I've given his mechanics an A grade in the past. I think he has a great delivery. But what's interesting about him, so he's throwing the ball not quite as hard as he used to, but also because of the lack of balance, he's not getting the same extension that he used to. And that's what made him really effective, was both he and center guard. They release the ball so close to home plate that even when they're throwing 96, 97, it feels like it's 99 to the hitter. They have very little time to decide what to identify the pitch, to decide the location, before they have to figure out whether or not to swing. Well, Harvey has lost some of that distance, and he's lost some of the raw velocity. So a pitch that used to feel 98 might feel 95 now. And you give hitters that extra opportunity, plus you take away some command, which has been part of the issue this year. And, of course, he's not going to be quite as effective. I'm not worried about any Verducci effects yet. There's so little we know, and each player is so unique, is such an individual, that I'm not ready to put that on him at all. I think it might take a little bit of time to figure it out, but I think that he'll be fine. He's got a great pitching coach to show him the right way, and they've already started to identify what might be going on. So that means they're working to address it.
Okay. Once again, I guess that's good for Met fans and not good for everybody else, particularly National League hitters. So I want to go south now on 95 if I can, and I want to ask you about Vincent Velasquez, who's, I don't know, maybe been the breakout player thus far of the 2016 season, came over from Houston in the Ken Giles trade, if I'm remembering correctly. He was certainly not the headliner in that deal, and goodness, came out with 16 strikeouts the other day, and is, I think he's put together three now good starts for Philadelphia. What are you seeing from Velasquez?
Well, he's interesting, and he's actually a guy I liked more than the consensus when the trade went down. To me, he was the key to that trade. I'm not a big Mark Appel guy.
Neither am I.
So I thought the future was with someone like Velasquez. Now, what we've seen so far, I think it's really interesting that the Mets were able to hit him up yesterday because it was their second time seeing him. He has been impressive, no doubt. However, he's done so with kind of iffy command, and specifically his command to the arm side has been really rough. He's been able to hit glove side targets no problem, but he's had a hard time to the arm side, so that's inside to right-handed hitters. He hasn't been able to hit his spots. He did late in that 16 strikeout game. There's an excellent article on Baseball Prospectus written by Sam Miller, and he kind of broke down, even though Velasquez is sitting there with 16 strikeouts, he had been missing spots. He also had a very simple approach. He basically threw all fastballs the first time through the order, then he mixed in his curve. So I see a pitcher that has good stuff, and that, in my opinion, was better than folks were appreciating heading into the year, but now, in kind of the typical hype fashion, I think people have gone overboard because he has a very simple approach. He's basically a two-pitch guy, fastballs and curveballs. And even when he was dominating the Padres, he really was only locating to one side of the plate. So if you're throwing pretty much two pitches and you're throwing it to the same part of the plate, the first time the Mets saw him, maybe they didn't realize this. Velasquez is new to the National League. He's someone that they haven't seen much of. They don't have a big advanced scouting report on him. Well, now they have seen him. So they saw him a second time. All of a sudden, they were laying off those pitches. This is a guy who was throwing the same junk and was having the same problems. And by junk, I mean a guy who's throwing 96. So obviously, I don't mean actual junk. he's a great pitcher. But I think the reality is obviously something south of what we saw against the Padres. Part of that was the Padres' offense just wasn't a terrible funk, and they're not very good to begin with. But Velasquez, I think that teams, when they get the book on him, they're going to be, if he can't hit his spots on the arm side, he's going to be having some issues day to day. I think that the Phillies are in a great position to sort of see what happens, and they should be careful with him. But at the same time, I expect some hiccups, and I expect some ups and downs. But I think that he's better than folks realize going into the year, and that was already true before the start even happened. And now, because he struck out 16 Padres, now all of a sudden everyone's on top of him, and so there's almost no choice but for him to disappoint right now.
So with your scouting hat on, what does he settle in long-term?
Long-term, it really depends on the development of that third pitch. I hate using that because it feels – I try to avoid scouting cliches, and to me, that's one of the scouting cliches, is that You see all sorts of guys at fastball, breaking ball, but they lack off speed, and whether or not they can develop off speed determines whether they're a bullpen guy or a rotation guy. Velasquez is young. I think that, you know, he does throw a changeup occasionally. I think there's potentially a future with that. I'm a huge fan of the split finger pitch for this reason, is because it's an off speed pitch that looks just like a fastball. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for the hitter to read out of hand. It's really easy to coach from the coaching perspective. So I would love to see him add something like that. So long term is hard to say. I hope that because he has a pretty solid delivery, I hope that he can maintain the velocity over time without losing anything as far as command, or as the command improves, although he doesn't sacrifice velocity to get there. But he has a little ways to go. And if I had him in a fantasy league, I'd be trying to deal him. If I'm the Phillies, I would just be very careful with his usage patterns and be willing to pull him if his command is awry, no matter what his pitching line looks like.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. One more guy I want to ask you about, and it's a little off script before we settle in Washington, but Jose Fernandez.
Yeah.
We've seen some, I mean, his stuff is out of control. I mean, I'm not even sure we need to comment on that, but just long-term health and the slider usage, how good it is. What do you think about Jose Fernandez?
That pitch is unworldly.
Right?
It's ridiculous. If we were to do kind of a Space Jam scenario and pick the best pitchers and show the aliens something they've never seen before, you give him Fern's defector. That thing is insane. And on top of it, he throws crazy hard. He has a really efficient delivery. And people might say, wait, this is a guy that got hurt. How can his delivery be solid? Look, when you're putting that much strain on the elbow because of how hard he's throwing, but also the torque that he's putting on the forearm. And I usually use torque in a different way. I usually use it to describe what we call hip-shoulder separation. It's a way of figuring out how well a pitcher uses his body to generate velocity. But I also use torque sometimes to describe how a pitcher is throwing a pitch. So the safe way to throw a breaking ball is to use supination. So it's kind of like a karate chop. If you can imagine turning your palm towards your body. And in order to throw the defector, and I know that Fern is throwing, he's utilizing supination. He's not using the wrist twist, which is so dangerous. But in order to throw that defector, it takes a lot of supination. And the arm naturally pronates after release point. It turns the exact opposite way with the palm facing away from the body.
Mm-hmm.
So the more supination that a pitcher has to throw a pitch, the further that the arm has to pronate after release point. So with Fern, as effective as that pitch is, I worry about his usage of it. And he's been using it like crazy. The pitch is so awesome. I would like to see him bring it back a little bit. He has an excellent physical baseline such that he can command the fastball. I would like to see him work on that, utilize that fastball more, maybe utilize a secondary pitch more, just to give him another option. That pitch is nasty, but it shouldn't be used all the time. It's similar to the Darvish situation. Yu Darvish, he's the other one who has a breaking ball that, again, if I could show it to aliens and say this is abnormal but insanely awesome, then I would use Yu Darvish as the example, or I would use Fern. But again, this is a pitch that requires a lot of strain on the arm. So that's the whole slider usage thing and all of that. There is something to that. And it does add more risk to the player. So I would like to see him bring that back a little bit, especially the most important thing right now, I think, is maintaining fastball velocity and having fastball command even way above that. The velocity is just secondary.
Very cool. Very, very good points. Let me now get to DC and ask you about Steven Strasburg, who's really, since he's got healthy about midway through last season, maybe end of the All-Star break time, has been maybe the best pitcher in baseball, and now has added a slider. I guess the question I'm asking is, has Strasburg taken the step forward, or are you seeing the same thing?
I think he has taken a step forward, and for years he used to frustrate the hell out of me. So I went to grad school at San Diego State while he was pitching there, so I got to see him a bit in college. I thought he had a better delivery in college than he did in the pros. And every year it got worse and worse, and what would drive me nuts, it's not even that something fundamental was wrong with him. His balance was okay, his torque was okay, his momentum and timing was fine, but he was offline.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as someone who's watched the Nats, I'm sure you saw how many starts where he just couldn't hit targets on the glove side. He would force it. he would start striding more to the glove side. You would see that front shoulder open up early. You would start trunk rotation early. He would do all these things to try to hit targets on the left side of the plate, and he struggled with it. And the more he struggled, the more frustrated I got, because he was getting away from what he did well, just being able to repeat his delivery and to be lined up. Well, that's what I'm seeing this year. In fact, the first pitch he threw of this year was like, whoa, wait a second. He's actually striding straight at the plate. He looks like he can hit a target on either side of the plate without changing his stride, without changing his timing, without altering anything. That's what I've been waiting to see from this guy. He's always had the stuff. It's just that he couldn't command it. And to me, Strasburg is a perfect example of why command is should be first and foremost on the hierarchy. Because frankly, if a guy's throwing 97 or he's throwing 95, it's going to be effective if he can put it where he wants to. And that's something that working under Tom House, he was Nolan Ryan's pitching coach in Texas. And so he used to quote a lot of Nolanisms. And one of them was, you know, he used to talk about whether or not Nolan was tipping his pitches. And Nolan would say, well, look, if I put the ball where I want to, they're not going to hit it no way. So, you know, now granted, he had insane stuff. But to me, command is that important. And Strasburg is a perfect example. You can have stuff with no command and you get what Strasburg's been for the last few years. But you add command to a guy who already has nutty stuff and you have what he's been this year. And to me, that's been the ceiling. And I've been waiting to see this. This is a guy who has great mechanical baselines, inverted W aside, all that stupid stuff aside. This is a guy who I think could be the best pitcher any given year in the National League. And I know it has Kershaw. So Kershaw's the better player. But as far as his performance any given season, I've been kind of waiting for Strasburg to do this. Before the year, he was actually my pick for the National League Cy Young, because I thought this is the year they take off the reins. For the Nats, it's their last year of control over the player. For Boris, you know, who has been very hands-on as far as limiting his workload, mm-hmm. Somewhat famously, all of a sudden now he has incentive to try to earn the paycheck for this offseason. You want to show that this guy can handle 200-plus innings, so he's going to be encouraging Strasburg to pitch as much as possible. So I think we have the perfect storm for what could be a nutty season, and I love what I've seen from him mechanically so far.
The next guy I got to ask you about with the Nats, and the final guy I want to ask you about, is Joe Ross. I think we've all kind of gotten into he looks a lot like his brother. Great fastball. The slider's, you know, one of the best sliders in baseball last year, but the changeup hadn't really come around. What do you see in Joe Ross?
Well, you know, it's funny because that's typically a cop-out answer, is to say, well, he's just like his brother and he has the same approach and blah, blah, blah. In Joe Ross's case, it's very true.
They look
his
identical.
His delivery looks like
similar.
Tyson's.
Yeah.
Approach looks like Tyson's. I mean, he doesn't throw quite as hard. He's not quite as big, but he's figured it out more quickly, and he has better command at a younger age. Now, what's always driven me nuts about Tyson Ross was how slow his delivery was. When he was with the A's, he had one of the shallowest strides I've ever seen, and that's despite being like 6'6". Now, Joe Ross also has a slow delivery, but it's not the extreme that Tyson's was. Now, Tyson's slowly getting better since he's been with the Padres. But with Joe Ross, I don't see that as being nearly as much of an issue. I do think that people need to temper their expectations. This isn't, you know, his fastball, it's averaging like 92.5 this year. He's a guy with a high floor but a low ceiling. He's basically a perfect number three. I think the Nats will be stoked using him as a number three. If the expectations are that he's going to be better than that, people are going to be disappointed. But I really like Joe Ross. I really like what he brings to the table. I'm stoked to see that the Nats are trusting him a little bit more. And for a rotation that already has Scherzer and Strasburg, he's perfect.
Yeah, I think that's pretty encouraging for Nats fans. I think it's been what a steal of a trade to get him and also Trey Turner for, goodness, Steven Souza. So.
Yeah, wow. The Padres made a number of moves that were now looking very questionable.
Yeah, that one's really going to hurt long term as well when they need a shortstop desperately and a starting pitcher as well. Doug, I could talk pitching with you literally all day long, but for maybe the sake of the audience and your time as well, I want to kind of cut the conversation here a little bit. I want to give you a spot to plug where people can find your work, where they can buy your books, where anything you want to plug, please plug away.
Okay, well, I mean, it was basically, you introduced it perfectly. I write for Baseball Prospectus, for RotoWire, for RotoGrinders. The book is available. It's called Arm Action, Arm Path, and the Perfect Pitch. That's available on Amazon.com. We published it back in 09, but the stuff is still, it would still be novel to most readers. And that's what kills me, is when we were talking earlier about the direction that things are going. We knew better than this 10 years ago. And yet, not only is it going, but it's going downhill. And if anyone's run downhill, they know how hard it is to stop. I'm really worried about trying to stop that momentum. But there's a ton of things in that book that still haven't been appreciated or understood to this day. And so I'm still very proud of the material we put in there. It was also the first time that motion capture data was made available to the public. So I would, you know, some people have knocked the fact that we only used a sample of 33 pitchers. But actually, we were upgrading our technology at the time. So those were just the 33 last pitchers to have gone through our system. It wasn't a case of cherry picking or anything like that. It was, I wanted to show off the newest data and the newest stuff that we had. And that was the sample of pitchers we had to work from. But we had data going back 10 years that validated everything that we said. So even though I completely understand and agree with some of the criticisms, I encourage people to, my angle has always been with all of this stuff, figure it out for yourself. Use it as a jumping off point. Start looking for these things. The biggest thing that I got at the National Pitching Association was it changed the way that I watch pitching. And I've been a baseball junkie my entire life, but it made me look out for things and start to appreciate different aspects. And it just allowed me to grow as a fan. And that's what I hope people get from my material, no matter where it is that it changes the way that they look at the game and they start to appreciate some of the nuance.
Well, I can't wait to get the book. And I must say, as I told you off air in our emails, I look forward to your columns every week at BP, and really, they are just fascinating to me. So I want to thank you for joining me today. I got to have you on sometime later in the season to talk again about pitching, and I'm going to have a dozen questions after I re-listen to this audio about follow-up questions and things. So thank you again for joining me, and I hope to talk to you again in the future.
Sounds good. You know I'll be down. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Thanks so much. And that was my conversation with Baseball Prospectus and pitching guru Doug Thorburn. Wow, that blew my mind. That was a really, really fun 45-minute conversation, and I've got so many more questions to ask him. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, because I really enjoyed that conversation and talking about pitching. So before we get out of here, I want to give one more shout-out to our sponsor, No Halftime, and the No Halftime app. You can find them at nohalftime.com, or you can go on and find them in the App Store on your iPhone or your Android as well. So check them out. Episode 64 is a wrap. Bye for now.